Okay, so we've pulled out the refuge tree again, and there's certainly one, two, and possibly one or two others who've forgotten what the refuge tree is about. So basically, it's in three dimensions, but you can't paint in three dimensions, so it's in two and facing you. But it's a lotus tree. So what you've got to imagine is as a initial lotus at the front, and Sangharakshita, the founder of Tri Ratna, with his main teachers that he knew in Kalimpong, is around him. But the central figure, of course, is the Buddha. So this is a Tri Ratna refuge tree. There are other refuge trees in the Tibetan tradition. So all the figures, Buddhist figures, that have influenced Sangharakshita, he asked Arloka, order member who's a painter, to paint them in the early 90s. So we've been working our way through these. And I say, you can imagine these lotus, branches of a huge lotus, and they've all got figures on. Now these figures are the bodhisattvas, and they're mythical figures. They didn't exist. Likewise, you've got these mythical gods and goddesses singing in the heavens, and the five dhyana Buddhas sitting there, and again, they're mythical. But everybody else, including the Buddha Shakyamuni, actually existed in time. So the oldest one on the tree in time is Shakyamuni, who lived 2,500 years ago. So tonight I'm going to talk about a Chinese master who's on the refuge tree, and Virinaga, I think, it's this character. there's two Japanese ones, and two more Japanese, and there's three Chinese ones, and we think it's this one.
Which one?
This one looks like a high court judge. Looks like a high court judge. So first of all, I think I need to paint a bit of a picture of what China was like in the early part of the Common Era. Buddhists tend to refer to as the Common Era rather than AD. So it's before Common Era, when Christ was supposedly born, and after Common Era. So in the early part of China was a very developed civilization, more so than anywhere in the West. And it was equal to other ancient civilizations, Greece and Egypt. And they had writing in all those three ancient civilizations. Buddhism arrived in China in the first century Common Era, carried by Indian Buddhist monks traveling along the Silk Road. You've probably all heard of the Silk Road. And it was really taken on board by several emperors, and it quickly spread. And it was extensively adopted by the ruling elite class, mainly because Buddhism had its stress on morals and ethics, in contrast to Confucianism and Taoism that emphasized hierarchy and filial obedience. By the 3rd century, a civil service was well underway in China. Writing and education were well established for the elite classes. In the 4th century, a number of other Indian Buddhist monk texts were carried to China from Mongolia by a man called Kumarajiva, and he's not on our refuge tree. He stayed in India, in China, and translated these Indian texts from Sanskrit into Chinese. And the most important ones he translated, the Mahayana texts, the Prajnaparamita literature, which includes the Heart Sutra, for those familiar with the Sevenfold Puja, the Lotus Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra. Come back to the Diamond Sutra in a minute with this book. The Indian monk Bodhidharma arrived in India early in the 5th century. Because of his approach to Buddhism, various Chan or Zen sects were established, And Bodhidharma became the first Chan or Zen patriarch. So that's the scene in China. And now we turn to Wei Ning. Wei Ning. He lived between 600 and 700 in the Tang dynasty. He recounted his biography in his introduction to the Platform Sutra, from which I've extracted these notes. After Wei Neng's father lost his government post and was banished to become a commoner, he died not long after. Wei Neng, as a young child, then found himself in poverty and had to support his mother by selling firewood to shopkeepers in the marketplace of Canton in southern China. One day, outside the shop where he just sold some firewood, he heard a man reciting a sutra. Wei Neng says in his biography, "As soon as I heard the text, I became enlightened." And then he asked the man the name of the text, and he was told it was a Diamond Sutra. To give it its full title, the Vajracchedika Sutra. Inquiring further, Wei Neng discovered the man reciting was a monk from a monastery ...30 days' journey away. A friendly shopkeeper gave Wei Neng some money so his mother would not be destitute when he went away to this monastery. So he made his 30-day journey. Like Tibetan Buddhism, with its lineage of teachers, Chinese Buddhism has its own lineage of patriarchs in all its different sects and traditions. Young Wei Neng was granted an audience with the fifth Zen patriarch. And he said to the patriarch, the abbot of the monastery, if you like, "I've travelled far to pay respect and ask for nothing but Buddhahood." The patriarch replied, "You're a native of Kwantung, a barbarian. How can you expect to be a Buddha?" Wei Neng, this young man, replied, "Although there are northern men and southern men, north and south make no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is different from your holiness physically, but there's no difference in our Buddha nature." It's quite a statement he's making to the abbot. At that point, other monks entered the room and the patriarch said no more except to order Wei Neng to work. But he did say something else. Wei Neng wasn't going to be shut up. "May I tell your highness that pranya, transcendental wisdom, often arises in my mind. When one does not go astray from one's essence of mind, one may be called the field of merits." The patriarch was a bit taken back. "This barbarian is too bright. Go to the stable yard and speak no more." Wei Neng, I'm not abashed, "I do not know what work your holiness would ask me to do." And he went off to the stable yard. At this point, he started chopping wood and pounding rice. And I want to leave Wei Neng at this point and discover what it was in the Diamond Sutra that's had such an impact on him. In doing so, I'm going to come right up to date to the founder of Tri Ratna, Sangharakshita, in a quote from his introduction to and his commentary on the Diamond Sutra. I've got to copy of the Diamond Sutra and the Platform Sutra of Wei Neng. They're not published by Windhorse. It's quite an old book, this. There have been other translations since then. But Sangharakshita has done a commentary on the Diamond Sutra in this book. which you can get from Windhorst.
Is that Wisdom Beyond Words?
Sorry?
Is it Wisdom Beyond Words?
Yes. Wisdom Beyond Words, thank you. Precise. So what Sangharakshita says in the introduction to the Diamond Sutra, I came across the Diamond Sutra in the summer of 1942 when I was 17, then still living in London, Tooting to be exact, though shortly to be conscripted into the army, into the Signal Corps, and shipped off to India. I was reading all the Oriental teachings and translations, particularly Buddhist ones I could lay my hands on. It was inevitable that sooner or later the Diamond Sutra should fall into my hands, or rather, perhaps, I should fall into the hands of the Diamond Sutra. When I encountered it, the sutra together with the Platform Sutra made an impression on me that can be truly described as tremendous. I call it an impression, but it was more like an impact. Just reading these two texts for the first time was an overwhelming spiritual experience which changed the whole course of my life. Or I should say that it made me realize for the first time what the course of my life really was. It made me realize I was a Buddhist, whatever that may mean. Before we return to Wei Neng pounding rice, I should attempt to say what the Diamond Sutra, or give its correct title, the Vajracchedika Paramita Sutra is about. It's one of the wisdom sutras, and as Sangharakshita says in the introduction, it comes from the enlightened mind of Buddha Shakyamuni. One is face to face with reality. We make contact with reality itself. The light of reality shines through our thick veil of ignorance. The transcendental wisdom cuts through all our thoughts, perceptions and ideas, and all our concepts about reality, all our metaphysical assumptions, with a diamond thunderbolt. It shatters all our negative emotions, our fear, our anxiety, our anger, our jealousy, our possessiveness, our clinging and our craving. Above all, it smashes you as you present, know yourself. But it comes with a health warning. If you're not ready for it, leave it alone. That's Sangharakshita's health warning, probably mine as well. A 7th century Chinese Buddhist scholar, Han Shan, in his commentary of the Diamond Sutra, makes the point that the Buddha Shakyamuni resolves the unspoken doubts of one of his disciples, Subhuti, with a series of blows that breaks down the rational thinking. It's done through a series of questions from the Buddha to Subhuti. So in these texts, that's what happens. It's a conversation between the Buddha Shakyamuni and Subhuti, one of his disciples. There's some paradoxes in there. So it's just a conversation between Shakyamuni and Subhuti, not our Subhuti, but the Buddha's Subhuti. So let's leave the Diamond Sutra and return to Wei Neng pounding rice in 6th century China in a monastery stable yard. After 8 months, a patriarch came across Wei Neng and told him, I know your knowledge of Buddhism is very sound, but I have to refrain from speaking to you, lest evildoers should do you harm. Wei Neng said, yes, sir, I do know, and to avoid people taking notice of me, I dare not go to your meditation hall. Some time later, the patriarch assembled all his disciples and said, "Go and seek the essence of your mind in pranya and write me a stanza about it. Who understands what the essence of mind is, I shall hand on my patriarch robe and bowl." They all left the meditation hall to set about composing a stanza. However, they decided the most accomplished one amongst them, the patriarch's foremost disciple, Shen Shu, who led their study, would naturally become the next patriarch, and the resolve not to compete against him. Shen Shu composed a stanza, but decided against showing it to the patriarch, in case his knowledge was not considered deep enough, and he was thought to be after the succession. However, Shen Shu decided to write his stanza late one night on a wall near the meditation hall, and he wrote, "Our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind is a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour, and let no dust alight." Nobody had seen him write, and he went to his room wondering what the patriarch's response would be. The patriarch knew already his disciple had not entered the door of enlightenment, and he didn't know his essence of mind. However, the patriarch called the monks together and told them to memorize the stanza they saw on the wall and recite it, through which they would gain great merit. He privately told Shen Shu he didn't know his essence of mind and he should make another attempt at composing a stanza. Meanwhile, Wei Neng was pounding rice, unaware of the test the patriarch had set, until he heard a young monk reciting the stanza aloud and instantly knew the composer hadn't realized essence of mind. The young monk explained to Wei Neng the circumstances of the stanza test, and Wei Neng asked to be taken to see it so he might learn it himself. Wei Neng was still illiterate. I had to ask an official of the monastery to read it stanza to him. He then told the official he too had composed a stanza and asked him to write it on the wall. "There is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is void, work and dust alight." The monks, when they saw Wei Neng's stanza, were overwhelmed and wondered how they'd managed to treat a bodhisattva as a servant. When the patriarch saw the stanza, he rubbed it off with his shoe and went to where Wei Neng was pounding rice with his stone pestle. It's not like the thing you have it in your kitchen at home, a stone pestle, these little bowls we have at home or can have. In the monasteries, the huge stone bowls and huge pestles. The patriarch asked and said to Wei Neng, "A seeker of the path risks his life for the Dharma. Should he not do so?" Then he asked if the rice was ready. Wei Neng replied, "Ready long ago, only waiting for the sieve." The patriarch knocked the mortar with his stick three times and left. Knowing what his message meant, Wei Neng went to the patriarch's room at the third watch of the night in secrecy, and the patriarch expounded the Dharma to Wei Neng. At that point, when the patriarch used the sentence, "One should use one's mind in such a way that it will be free from any attachment," Wei Neng claimed he'd become thoroughly enlightened. He recounts what he said to the patriarch after his realization. "Who would have thought the essence of mind is intrinsically pure? Who would have thought that all things are the essence of mind. The patriarch told Wei Neng he'd inherited and deserved the patriarch's robe and bow and would become the sixth patriarch, but he should leave the monastery immediately with the patriarch's help. Wei Neng left the monastery that night, fearing for his life. He headed south, pursued by attackers, trying to get his robe and bowl. He hid for 13 years before he finally revealed himself and began teaching the Dharma as the sixth patriarch. So, some quotes from the Platform Sutra. This is Wei Neng's sutra. Non-objectivity means not to be absorbed by objects when in contact with objects. Non-attachment is a characteristic of our essence of mind. All things, good or bad, beautiful or ugly, should be treated as void. Even in times of disputes and quarrels, we should trying to make out my English. We should treat our inmates and our enemies alike and never think of retaliation. In the essence of our thinking faculty, let the past be dead. If we allow our thoughts, past, present and future, to link up in a series, we must ourselves, under restraint, become under restraint. On the other hand, if we never let our mind attach to anything, we shall gain emancipation. For this reason, we take non-attachment as a fundamental principle. Secondly, to take refuge in ourselves, to be constantly on the alert for our mistakes and to refrain from criticism of others, merits or faults. He who is humble and meek on all occasion and is polite to everybody has thoroughly realized his essence of mind. So thoroughly that is a path free from further obstacles. That is the way to take refuge in oneself. The profundity of the teachings of various Buddhas has nothing to do with the written language. I want to say a little bit about the sudden and gradual school in Chinese Buddhism. And again, a quote from Wei Neng. While there is only one Dharma, some disciples realize it more quickly than others. The reason why the names sudden and gradual are given is that some disciples are superior to others in mental dispositions. But so far as the Dharma is concerned, the distinction of sudden and gradual does not exist. At that time, shortly after Wei Neng, there was a school of Buddhism in northern China, which was the gradual school. Wei Neng stayed in the south, and his was known as the southern school. So he was referring to the sudden and gradual school as a young educated boy on first hearing the Diamond Sutra being recited, and he claims to he became enlightened. However, further in the Platform Sutra, he mentioned he becomes enlightened, like I just mentioned, when he was taught by the patriarch at night in secret. I have no doubt Wei Neng was enlightened, but when he was enlightened is a matter of conjecture. The Chan or Zen schools of Buddhism use the term Satori, which in other traditions means insight. Maybe that explains the confusion. Wei Neng just had Satori or insight at first, when he first heard it, like Sangharakshita. Also, when practicing Buddhism, Buddhists who claim sudden insight or enlightenment, it's a result of practice in whatever form, whether it's meditation, study, koan, or chanting or ritual devotion. So in my opinion, we're all on a gradual path until there's a breakthrough. Sangharakshita was denied, and he claims he is enlightened, and is cautioned against any Buddhist who makes claims about spiritual achievement. Undoubtedly, Sangharakshita has achieved a great high degree of insight. One can discern that when he began teaching in London by his seminars and talks and the many books he's published. For me, I can leave the Diamond Sutra and the Platform Sutra aside. But for me, what Sudhika mentioned last week is this text, the Bodhicaryavatara that Shantideva so magically gave us. The reason that I can respond to that one is that, and why it's always been important to me, is because it brings together both the rational mind, the synthesis of the rational mind and devotion directed to saving all sentient beings. So it's a really true Mahayana text. While I was preparing for this in the last week, I've been rereading the Diamond and Platform Sutras in preparation. And whilst I can say my understanding is deeper when I first read them years ago, I know my understanding is still tainted by my intellectual understanding. As I read further into the Platform Sutra, I was left with a question: how did an illiterate man who became the sixth patriarch of Chan gain such extensive knowledge and was able to quote from Buddhist texts? I don't know. I've not found anywhere how that is explained. As I said earlier on, the Pranyaparamita Sutras, such as the Diamond and Platform Sutras and the Heart Sutra, is to undercut our conceptual thought. So next time you recite the Heart Sutra in a seven-pool puja, bear that in mind, it's trying to undercut your conceptual thought. So nearly finished. I suspect Sangharakshita at 17, when he first read these first two sutras, although he realised he was a Buddhist, had an understanding of the sutras to a certain extent, and he knew he'd found a journey or path to follow in Buddhism. But before he could develop the insight he now has, he had to follow the Buddhist path. His journey took him via conscription into the army in the Second World War, to stay in India from 1945 until he came back to London in the mid-60s. After he left the army, he travelled to the south of India with an Indian friend. For 2 years they lived the life of wandering shramanas, travelling barefoot in rag robes, begging for food and meditating. Then they headed north to be ordained as Theravada monks. And Sangharakshita eventually settled in Kalimpong in 1950, where he lived as a monk, teaching meditation, and continued to support himself by begging until he finally left Kalimpong in the mid-60s. Whilst in Kalimpong, he met and was given advanced visualization and meditation practice by the Rinpoches who fled Tibet when the Chinese invaded in 1949, and from Yogi Chen, a Chinese man on our refuge retreat. He learned Zen Buddhism. These are the teachers surrounding Sangharakshita, the teachers of the present. What I've been talking about is one of the teachers of the past. During his time in Kalimpong, Sangharakshita wrote extensively and delivered lectures in India, including what was later published as a Survey of Buddhism, which for many years in the West was considered the most comprehensive and insightful work on Buddhism that's ever been written. We can be grateful he returned to London in 1968 and began to share his understanding of the Dharma and founded what we know as Triratna, and it's spread across the world. I just want to quote something from a Tibetan text now. This means quite a lot to me. It is a great joy to realize that the path to freedom that all Buddhas have trodden is ever existent, ever unchanged, and ever open to those who are prepared to enter upon it. So that's it, the Platform Sutra. And we've got quite a bit of time left. Between Buri and Aga and I, we'll try and answer your questions, if you've got any. Maybe Wayne Enger's completely undercut your conceptual minds. Something's happened.
Is the Heart Sutra part of?
It's a Pranayaparamita text, yeah.
But no part of the Dhyana
no,
Sutra?
No. It's there's in this book of Sangharakshita's, he does a commentary on the Heart Sutra. Yes, which he gave as a seminar years ago. So that's printed in here, as is the commentary on the platform, not the Platform Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, and one other Pranayaparamita text. So, yeah.
I got a bit confused. Did you kind of summarise three sutras then, the Heart?
The Heart.
Diamond and Platform.
Was yeah, that's three I just mentioned. There are other Pranayaparamita sutras. And in fact, there's one that's written in 1,000 lines, and the same text is written in one line, I think. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a lot of those texts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're all designed to just undercut your conceptual mind.
Sorry, Pranayaparamita, which is, what was the meaning?
Pranya means wisdom, transcendental wisdom. Mitra.
They're considered the distillations of wisdom.
Well, it's Mitrata, it's a translation. It's a distillation, isn't it? Yeah. Pranya means in transcendental wisdom, that's an important word.
Yeah.
And the Diamond Sutra, if you remember, is the Vajracchedika Sutra, a diamond thunderbolt sutra, so that's undercutting your conceptual mind.
Can you unpick that sentence for me? Like, I'm not sure I understand the undercutting the conceptual mind. I mean, what does it actually mean?
Because every time you have a thought, it's undercutting it. So, that... Let me give an example in the Diamond Sutra from Sangharakshita's commentary. So I'll just go into this. So the Buddha and his disciple Subhuti are sitting there. So that's the scene. The Buddha says to Shakyamuni, the Buddha Shakyamuni says to Subhuti, someone who has set out in the vehicle of the Bodhisattva, that's to say all sentient beings, should produce a thought in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, egg-born, born from a womb, moisture-born, or miraculously born, with or without form, with perception, without perception, and with neither perception nor non-perception, as far as any conceivable form of beings is conceived, all these must lead to nirvana. Into the realm of nirvana, which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. That's enlightenment. And why? If a bodhisattva has the notion of a being, human being, should take place, and led to nirvana. No being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If a bodhisattva has the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a Bodhi being. And why? He is not to be called a Bodhi being, in whom the notion of a self, and that's the important thing, or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul of a person. So what that's about, I'm seeing you, Laura, and I think it's me, Ratnachuda. What the Buddha is trying to say to Subhuti, there's no essence of Laura, nor any of you, nor there's me. There's no being. I'm empty. But our conceptual mind, I think it's Laura. There's an object out there, Laura, I'm looking at now. And there's a subject, Ratnachuda, that's talking to, I'm directing my talk. But I've got a sense of Ratnachuda, and I've got a sense of Laura. But the Buddha's saying, neither exist. There's nothing.
But, so that's what he's saying.
But there is a relative Laura, and there's a relative Ratnachuda, and that's how we work on a day-to-day basis, like tonight. So that's where we're all working. But those texts are trying to undercut us all the time when we're in the world, when the objects are in the world. The number three bus route going past shortly, which I may not be getting home if I get a lift. There's no number three bus. It's just a lot of bits and pieces stitched together, just as you're a lot of bits and pieces stitched together, I am as well. Do you want to say some more?
Yeah. I mean, that is it, but I find it helpful to think in terms of a concept is always a simplification, you know, so a concept is never really completely accurate as to what it's representing, if you certainly. And if we relate to things in terms of concepts, like you're a concept, the concept of Laura, you know, concept of Ratnachuda, you know. But what we frequently do is in dealing with those concepts, we narrow, you know, and we fix, and that can't be right. If you see what I mean? Mm. So, you know, the Heart Sutra, one of the famous lines is, "Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form." And that's not saying that there's not nothing. It's saying that what we're putting on something as a form is inherently empty. Yeah, there's not, that concept can't truly be accurate. Certainly. And so what we're trying to do is not strictly relate to things in terms of fixed form, and that includes also ourselves. Because we think of ourselves as a fixed entity.
So it's quite useful to know there's a staircase there. Otherwise, you wouldn't get out. And there's a door there. That's how we need to go about in the world. Yeah, it's all relative, though. All that door is, it's a metal door, but it's made up of lots and bits and pieces, and you can't get to an essence of that door that's under there.
So is this
insubstantiality?
That's right. That's right, you got it. Yeah. I'm trying not to bring that word in there. Yeah.
I mean, another good metaphor is a river. You know, we call something a river, but there's no such thing as a river. What the river is it's lots of water that's flowing, if you see what I mean. But we would call it the Thames, for instance, and treat it as if it was a permanent thing. But it's not a permanent thing, it's a process, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. And we do that with everything is a process, but we even the staircase is actually a process, you know, even though it's quite a slow process. But we treat it as an object.
I get the impression that these disciples were constantly, maybe not constantly, but particularly in the story that you just read, being kind of pitted against one another. Not necessarily, but in a very competitive environment.
Yeah, the Buddha's disciples weren't like that, certainly. There was more of that in the Chan or Zen tradition, yeah.
The
Buddha is really using Subhuti to give a general teaching, that he picks up Subhuti particularly, yeah, because Subhuti was considered one of the most intellectual of his followers, yeah. Just as our Subhuti is as well. Yeah. So there wasn't a lot. They questioned each other, yeah, sure. Particularly after the Buddha died.
And the main character?
Sorry?
The main character that you read about?
Wei Nang?
Yeah, so he wasn't necessarily expected to achieve enlightenment because he was illiterate. But then he, you know...
There was something about that text, the Diamond Sutra, that sort of spoke to him as a young boy. And then when he got the teaching from the Patriarch, he claims he was thoroughly enlightened. I accept that's the case. Yeah.
And when he was chased away...
Yeah, because it was the monks, and particularly the leading monk, who thought he was going to get the Patriarch's robe. Yeah. Mm. So he hid amongst bandits, actually. They looked after him for 15 years. But he went well away from the monastery. And that the main disciple of the fifth Patriarch, he set up the gradual school in northern China. But he always paid obeisance to Wei Nang. He realised that Wei Nang was more developed than him. Yeah.
I was just going to say, when you keep talking about this undercutting,
mm-hmm.
without using the intellectual mind so much, does that relate in a way to some of the symbolic elements of, you know, for example, like the Zen Buddhism holding up the lotus?
Yeah, transmission and beyond the scriptures.
And seeing and understanding that without necessarily any sort of verbal communication, cutting out.
All it was a mind to mind communication, yeah, allegedly, yeah. Mahakashapa, yeah. I mean, I'll say a bit more about how I work with this Notratnatyuta. I, in my career, and even since I became a Buddhist, I've moved around quite a bit in one way or another, all for good reasons. I can remember conceptually, because I've got a very good memory. My memory is embarrassing to a lot of people because I can remember conversations from years ago. however, and I have been writing something about some of my past, and I can remember it in detail. The new bridge over the Forth is open today, and I can remember going across Frean's Ferry in an old sports car before there was the Forth Road Bridge in the early 60s. And a coach ran into the back of that car. And I can remember almost every detail in 1962 of that. I have no sense. I know all about the car and what happened to it and the crash. There was a whole line of us pushed along by a coach. I have no sense of me. Or even the woman that was with me at the time, who later became my wife. I know her name, obviously. But I've no sense of me. Just as when I lived at Rivendell more recently in the 90s, I can remember so much about my life there for 5 years. When I go inside, I can't find me. And I'm quite happy with it. Yeah. So that's how I work with it. I make a point of looking back at my life, trying to access this me. Yeah.
So you mean that you can't identify yourself with the person in the past?
No, I can remember all those details because I've got this incredible. I can't find this person that did all those things at Rivendell, built the chalet. I know exactly.
So you can sort of see that unsubstantiality when you go. When you look into the past and see that actually, who was that person? That sort of exercise.
Right, I'll ask you a devilish question, Elaine. I know it so well. You were brought up in Barcelona.
Yeah.
Just go inside for a minute. Can you picture what you were like as a who that teenager.
Yeah, no, I know. No, it's funny because I've been feeling that recently and thinking of that, trying to identify myself with that person, and yeah, you can't find it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting.
But you can sort of construct it.
Yeah. They can't find this essence of me.
But that construct is not surely meaningless.
Oh, no, no, no. Because when I think of those things, and I construct, to use your word, I think what I achieve, say, in Rivendell. So I'm quite happy about what it was that was doing those things. And part of the time it was Robert, then I became Ratna Tudor. So I'm happy with that construct. But I can't actually enter into the person that built the chalet and did those ponds. Yeah. All right, Geeta, try you and know you so well. What was it like growing up? Can you get in touch with the Geeta in Germany, brought up in Germany? I know you lived over here a long, long time. And you go back to Germany quite a lot.
Well, I think it's important for me to make the distinction between sort of recognizing the past conditions that got me here. It's not as if now it was completely void of the past, because the conditions are still playing part in now. But they change. So I'm not the same, but the conditions are influencing it.
Mm.
And I guess what we were talking about, where we want to get to, is with the mind stuff, you know, with sort of not fixing, that we can let go of our self more, that we're not so much the center of the universe. Does that make sense what I mean? So if we think about ourselves and the stairs and the doors and the Tudor and everybody, we fix it. And then it's hard in fixing everything, we fix ourselves. But actually, if we can let go of ourselves more, of the importance of ourselves, we get more of a sense of being
free,
being connected.
Connected to everything.
You
so
got
I think
it.
That's the
good. Do you want to do next week? You've done a good job there.
Yeah.
Very good, yeah, appreciate that. You brought a lot out that I didn't. Connected, that's the secret of it. I touched on it a little bit with Jane tonight when I went straight from the mindfulness of breathing into that short metta-bhavana. We connected to Jane, those of us have been coming here. So we have a chance to stay a little more connected with her because of tonight. Yeah, although she'll be in Plymouth. Okay, we've just about reached the end of the evening. Is there anything else that's burning issue?
A quick question.
Yes, Rick.
You mentioned that lineage and how that was important to one of the traditions you were talking about. And I've heard this come up quite a lot, and some traditions seem to be quite, like to emphasise the lineage. Can you explain what it is and why it's important?
Particularly the Tibetan traditions. We don't have lineage. Sangharakshita has teachers that he gave him some teachings when he lived in Kalimpong, but he's not claiming he's come from any of their lineage. But all of those Chinese Tibetan teachers, they have got quite a lineage going back. And so even if you go over to Rigpa on the Holloway Road, Sogyal Rinpoche, who came through Kalimpong while Sangharakshita was there as a little boy escaping from Tibet. Whenever you hear Sogyal Rinpoche talk, he always talks about his master, the one who gave him the teachings. Funny enough, it's one of Sangharakshita's teachers as well. It's like he's not owning anything himself, whereas Sangharakshita's way of teaching, it's from his own, what he's understood in the Dharma himself. But very often the Tibetan teachers, particularly the modern ones, they're always referring back to a lineage as though they're unsure of themselves. With the Japanese teachers, and I know a lot more about those, they pay homage to the teachers of the past, particularly Shinran, who I know a lot about, and Milarepa, who's very important to us. He always pays everything his teaching, which is all song, he always pays homage to his teacher, but he doesn't quote from his teacher. So does that sort of clear it up? It seems like they need to, when they're referring to that master or teacher, they're not just saying thank you and gratitude. If they're saying more than that, I'm just left curious. Yeah.
In the broadest sense, it's really just the Dharma being passed down.
That's the important thing.
I mean, that, in some ways, that goes right back to the Buddha. But yeah, there is formal lineages in certain traditions.
I'll just finish with that nice little quote, which just actually says what Parinaga said. This is from another Tibetan text, which is not in this. It is great joy to realize the path to freedom that all the Buddhas have trodden is ever existent, ever unchanged, and ever open to those who are prepared to enter upon it. That's you. Keep coming back.